Since 2014, when the Bharatiya Janata Party came into power in India, the country's 200 million minority Muslims have complained of persecution, hate and violence. At the heart of this majoritarian project have been mosques and monuments and desperate attempts to convert them into Hindu temples. This obnoxious project, vigorously promoted by the Hindu nationalist government, involves rewriting India's history in line with the majoritarian Hindutva ideology by converting mosques and monuments from the medieval era into temples.
While incidents of hate crimes, mob lynching, discriminatory citizenship laws, incarceration of journalists and activists, anti-hijab campaigning, and demolition of Muslim homes and businesses have been the highlight of Narendra Modi's 8 years in power, the campaign to convert Muslim heritage sites into Hindu temples has lately gained momentum. BJP leaders and their ultra-right-wing ideological patrons claim that Muslim Mughal rulers destroyed 36,000 Hindu temples and it was time to reclaim them. From Varanasi's Gyanwapi Mosque to Mathura Shahi Idgah Mosque, Lucknow's Tiliwali Mosque, Bhopal's Jama Masjid, Karnataka's Malali Mosque, a vicious campaign is underway in India to raise down mosques. Historians argue the claims made by BJP leaders are baseless and outlandish, accusing them of inventing a history of their own to serve their political agenda. A series of petitions have been filed by right-wing Hindu groups against mosques across the country in recent months. In Mathura, a city in Uttar Pradesh state, the Shahi Idgah Mosque built by Mughal Emperor Aurangzeb in 1670 alone faces 12 lawsuits. The 17th century Gyanwapi Mosque in Varanasi is also embroiled in a legal case. Even a world-famous monument, the Taj Mahal, built by Mughal Emperor Shah Jahan, has not escaped litigation, with extremist Hindus claiming it was a Hindu temple containing Hindu relics.
The issue of mosques and Muslim worship has been at the center of BJP's communal politics since it rose to power on the back of a countrywide campaign over the destruction of the 16th century Babri Masjid in 1992. BJP claimed the mosque was built on the site of the birth of the Hindu god Ram, and its demolition in December 1992 marked a watershed moment in India's post-partition history. In 2019, the country's top court, in a snub to Muslims, handed over the mosque to Hindus.
The 400-year-old Babri Masjid in the small town of Ayodhya in the northern Indian state of Uttar Pradesh was razed to the ground by Hindu fanatics on December 6, 1992. It was estimated that more than 2,000 people died in the orgy of communal violence that swept through the country following the mosque's demolition. 4 years later, in the general election, Bharatiya Janata Party almost doubled its tally in parliament from 85 to 161, using the same Hindutva card. The campaign to build a temple at the disputed site in Ayodhya was later at the center of the party's anti-Muslim riots in Gujarat in 2002, which left more than 1,000 dead, the majority of them Muslims. During the pogrom, Muslim homes and businesses were identified and targeted by Hindu mobs. Hundreds of mosques and shrines were damaged. A medieval-era Muslim shrine in the city of Ahmedabad was razed to the ground. Following the massacre, Modi clinched state elections, proving again that anti-Muslim violence was the party's trump card. After Modi became the prime minister in 2014, the right wing felt emboldened to target mosques, ban the use of loudspeakers for azan, criminalize the wearing of hijab by Muslim women, and stoke communal tensions. Top Muslim political leaders such as Asaduddin Owaisi have drawn similarities between campaigns to convert mosques into temples with Babri Mosque demolition.
Now to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Zafar Bangash, the Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought. Welcome to the program, sir. Now, the BJP's majoritarian project has been centered around converting mosques and monuments into Hindu temples. Now, the question is, does it help the party's political fortunes?
Oh, of course. One of the planks of the BJP and the Hindutva Brigade is that they want to destroy all the mosques in India on the false allegation that these mosques are built on former temples. That's not the case at all. In fact, when Muslims ruled India, Muslim rulers not only protected the Hindu temples, but in many instances, the Muslim rulers actually provided land for the Hindus to build their temples and provided financial support for these temples to be built. Because Islam not only recognizes other religions, but there is a strong projection that Muslims must respect the religious places of other people, even if they disagree with them, as obviously Muslims do with the Hindus, because Hindus are mushriks, they have multiplicity of gods, but Islam prohibits targeting them or destroying their places of worship, because this is what Islam enjoins upon its adherents. But we see in India that the BJP has taken this campaign, launched this campaign to target mosques, destroy them, on the false allegation that these mosques stand on the grounds where there used to be temples. Muslims are prohibited from building new mosques, and when they can't find places such as mosques to pray, when the Muslims come out to pray outside, then the Hindus attack them there as well. There have been many, many instances in which Muslims have been attacked while they have been praying. So this right-wing fascist ideology that is raging throughout India has targeted the mosques in particular as well, because mosques are seen as symbols of religious identity for the Muslims. So this is part and parcel of the Hindu ideology, and by whipping up anti-Muslim sentiment among the majority of Hindus, the BJP tries to cash in on that vote, and since they constitute an absolute majority in India, when out of 1.2 or 1.3 billion people in India, Muslims are about 200 million, the Christians are probably about 20 million or so, and although the Dalits are about 200 million, but they have also been incorporated into the Hindu religion, despite the fact that the Dalits are discriminated against viciously.
Mr. Ghosh, BJP leaders claim that Mughal rulers destroyed thousands of Hindu temples and made mosques. Now, does this claim carry any weight in the light of historical records?
Yes, indeed. The demolition of Babri Mosque back in December of 1992 was a watershed moment in the history of Muslims in India. Now, that mosque in Ayodhya was built by the Mughal Emperor Babur in 1528. And Babur, of course, was a Mughal ruler. And the Hindus claimed that the Babri Mosque was built on a place where the Hindu god Ram was born. But it's interesting to note that there are two other places in the same city, Ayodhya, where the Hindus claim that their god Ram was born. Now, obviously, Ram could not have been born in three different places simultaneously. But the Hindu myth that they were propagating was because the Babri Mosque was a fairly imposing structure, and it was built by the first Mughal emperor Babur, and that's why the name Babri Mosque. And they wanted to show to the Muslims that the Hindus can get away with it. And that, of course, proved to be the precursor to this Hindutva campaign, in which the BJP members were actively involved. That campaign, the demolition of Babri Mosque, was led by L.K. Advani, who was at that time the leader of the BJP. But Narendra Modi was part of that campaign as well. And he was honing his murderous skills under Advani's patronage. And this was part of his sort of training that he participated in the campaign to destroy the Babri Mosque. And as a consequence of that, and by getting away with it, now the BJP and the Hindutva Brigade are going around in India destroying other mosques.
Last but not least, like you mentioned, the demolition of Babri Masjid in December of 1992 marked a water-washed moment in India's history. Now, the question is, can we draw any parallels between this and the campaign to convert mosques into temples today?
In India, attempts to ban the hijab of women, to ban the azan, etc., is a very serious omen for the future of Muslims in India. We know that even a former foreign minister of India, Salman Khurshid, who had written a book in which he had said that these Hindutva terrorists, the RSS and other terrorists in India, are the equivalent of Daesh or ISIS. And for that, Salman Khurshid's house was attacked and set on fire. He wasn't there at the time, but these Hindu terrorists can go that far. And Salman Khurshid had actually served as foreign minister in the Congress-led government. So if these Hindu terrorists can go that far, then we know very clearly as to what would be the fate of ordinary Muslims in India. They are discriminated against in education. They are discriminated against in employment. They are discriminated against in getting jobs, for instance, in the judiciary. Even when they try to set up businesses, their businesses are attacked. There are examples of several states in India where ordinary Muslim vendors are not allowed to have their push cart stalls on the streets, with the police saying that you are blocking traffic. But there are no such restrictions for Hindu push cart vendors. So in other words, Muslims are being undermined not only politically but economically and socially. And if economically they are undermined, then obviously it would be very difficult for Muslims to survive in India. And this is a major threat to the presence of Muslims in India.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Bangosh, the Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, for being on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Akash Hassan, a journalist, shares a Guardian report about how thousands of mosques are being targeted across India as Hindu nationalists attempt to rewrite the country's history. Law professor and author Khalid Baydoun notes that Islamophobia in India is as sweeping as bulldozing Muslim homes and mosques, and as petty as preventing a Kashmiri Muslim photographer from traveling to claim her Pulitzer Prize. Zafarul Islam Khan, a scholar and former chairman of Delhi Minorities Commission, writes about court cases against a 17th century mosque in India, noting that the purpose is to fatigue Muslims.
And that was our episode about the growing religious intolerance and political polarization in BJP-ruled India and the Hindu nationalist government's project to convert mosques into temples. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant factor.
Emmet is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu alaikum to you dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
شما وقتی یه کار خیری، حالا چه عبادت باشه، چه امور خیر دیگری باشه،
Whenever we do a deed, whether worship or charity, both positive and negative powers are at work. The positive power encourages you to continue, and the negative power discourages you not to continue the good work. As Imam Sajjad alayhi salam puts it, the carnal powers inside your soul make an obstacle on your way not to continue your good deed. One of the ways by which the Satan deceives us is by discouraging us from doing good deeds. The Satan whispers in our ears, "You are tired, leave the good deed." These are the inculcations of the carnal soul.
و یواش یواش شما وقتی میپذیری این رو وقتی میپذیری این تلقینات رو احساس
Gradually if we accept such satanic inculcations we feel tiresome. This is a fake sense of boredom because the main reason for that is satanic temptation and the call of the carnal soul to discourage you from doing good deed. Thus feeling tired to do good deed is a sign of satanic temptations, which is, of course, a fake type of laziness in doing good deeds. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.com/en Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, pleasure and perfection. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to this show, everyone. You're listening to A to Z program. And I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. In today's program, we're talking about pleasure and perfection as connected to the man himself, as connected to the human being. Provided that we, or the human being, considers that the objective as desirable and that we beware of it and we need to pay attention upon reaching it, we need to struggle upon reaching the amount of pleasure that we need in life. Thus, we do not regard something desirable. Reaching it will bring about no pleasure for us. And likewise, if we pay no heed to reaching something, we will derive no enjoyment from it. As a consequence, in addition to the presence of one who takes pleasure in something and the object of desire, taking pleasure depends on having a specific perpetual power with which reaching the desired objective could be perceived. And in the same way, it hinges on recognition of desirability and paying attention to reaching it. Various degrees of pleasure depend on the intensity and weakness of perception, as well as desirability or attention paid by man. That is to say, a person's enjoyment of eating delicious food might be more than someone else's, as he might have a stronger and healthier taste. Or a person might derive more enjoyment from eating a particular type of food, as it might be more pleasurable for him. Or a particular person might derive more enjoyment from a special dish when he fully concentrates on the food, rather than on other objectives. In like manner, two students might derive different types of enjoyment from learning a specific branch of science due to their different views on the desirability and due to their different views on the utility and practicality of it. So the degree of pleasure in every human being differs from one degree to the other. Someone can have more pleasure on the same thing and the other can have lesser pleasure on the same thing. All this depends on the views of their desirability, the views of their utility, and the practicality of how they're dealing with the matter.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z program from the IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Hussein Hinzano. Now, in today's show, we've been talking about the pleasure and perfection in the human being. It is clear that the stability of the pleasure depends on the endurance of conditions which lead to its emergence. The supposed pleasure is cut off when the one taking pleasure or the object of pleasure is destroyed, or when it is no longer desirable, or even when the person changes his mind or ceases paying attention to it. The multiplicity seen among the person taking pleasure, the objective of pleasure, and the conditions leading to the emergence of pleasure has general applicability in the case of ordinary pleasure. Now, the essence of pleasure, however, can be traced in other cases where no such multiplicity exists. In these cases, the word pleasure could be used with a kind of conceptual interpretation, as is the case with regard to science and fraction. We differ on how we go after the pleasure or any pleasurable deed according to how we are perceiving it, the concept that we are having towards it, the interpretation that we are having towards this particular attribute, this particular object, and thus making it different, making the world of pleasure in a man's world different from each and every human being. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. Until next episode, inshallah, we will sit together and talk about this. We will touch more about this. Thank you so much for following up. Until next episode, fi imanillah, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
In the limelight.
Economists are saying recession in the Eurozone is almost inevitable. According to surveys, the countries of the Eurozone will face an economic recession in the next year with a probability of about 80% due to a sharp increase in energy prices and a sharp decrease in the supply of electricity and gas. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Euronews has covered this story. According to the European Commission's autumn economic forecast, the Eurozone and most European Union countries will head to an economic recession in the last quarter of 2022. The European Union Economy Commissioner, Paolo Gentiloni, at a press conference said, "The economic situation has deteriorated markedly and we are heading into two quarters of contraction." The EU's executive revised up its inflation forecast from July, predicting that prices would peak at year-end and remain high in 2023. Brussels said inflation will average 9.3% in the European Union and 8.5% in the Eurozone for 2022. The European Commission said in a statement, "The European Union is among the most exposed advanced economies to high prices due to its geographical proximity to the war and heavy reliance on gas imports from Russia." The statement added, "The energy crisis is eroding households' purchasing power and weighing on production." While prices are expected to come down in 2023, inflation is still predicted to be at 7% in the European Union and 6.1% in the Eurozone, before decreasing to 3% in the European Union and 2.6% in the Eurozone in 2024. The EU forecast was based on the assumption that geopolitical tensions such as the war in Ukraine would neither normalize nor escalate, and that sanctions against Russia would remain in place. But the EU Economy Commissioner Paolo Gentiloni said the impact of adopted or planned fiscal energy measures adds uncertainty to the forecast for energy inflation. Average inflation for 2022 was highest in the Baltic countries, where it was forecast to be 19.3% in Estonia, 18.9% in Lithuania, and 16.9% in Latvia this year. EU labour markets are expected to react to the slowing economy, but remain resilient, with unemployment growth expected to be at 1.8% before coming to a standstill in 2023. Unemployment rates in the European Union were projected to be at 6.2% in 2022, 6.5% in 2023, and 6.4% in 2024. The European Central Bank, the ECB, has meanwhile raised interest rates 3 times this year to tackle the rising prices. The ECB could continue to raise interest rates, which impacts commercial banks, meaning that mortgages and credit cards would become more expensive. The central bank's governing council said at the end of last month that inflation remained far too high and will stay above the target for an extended period of time. According to Eurostat's flash estimate, at the end of the month, inflation in the eurozone reached a record high of 10.7% in October. The increase was fueled by energy prices, which Eurostat estimated were 41.9% higher than in the same month last year. Prices for food and tobacco were up by 13.1% compared to the same time last year. There have been multiple strike movements in European Union countries demanding higher wages because of record inflation. China's Xinhua news agency has also covered the same story. The European economy is slowing down and a contraction is predicted at least for the winter months due to the energy crisis and high inflation. Pascal Donohue, president of the Eurogroup, said everyone knows that the economy within the euro area is slowing down. In October, economic growth for the euro area stood at 0.5%, adding, "If we look at high-frequency indicators and the economic sentiment, we see that many things point to a contraction in economic activity this winter." The finance ministers representing the 19-country euro area met in Brussels, Belgium recently to discuss the eurozone's economic development, as well as budgetary measures to mitigate the impact of high energy prices. According to estimates by the European Commission, euro area governments have so far collectively spent about 200 billion euros, or 1.25% of the European Union's gross domestic product GDP, on energy support for the year. Pascal Donohue said around 70% of the supporting measures adopted by the member states so far are untargeted, meaning they benefit all or a very large share of the population. He added, "We are aware, of course, that targeting is not always easy, politically and technically, especially if you have to react very quickly. This is also why we have the expectation that this targeting of measures can improve in the coming months." Pascal Donohue added, "The ministers noticed the challenges of significant support and effectively managing the trade-off between reducing inflation while supporting both vulnerable households and the euro area's international competitiveness." The British newspaper The Guardian has also covered the same story. According to a survey, 1 in 4 Europeans described their financial position as precarious. More than half see a serious risk it will become so over the coming months, and 80% have already been forced into hard spending choices. As the cost of living crisis driven by high energy prices, rampant inflation, and the Russia-Ukraine conflict tightens its grip, the six-country survey for the French anti-poverty NGO Secours Populaire painted an alarming picture of a continent on the brink. More than half, or 54%, of more than 6,000 people across France, Germany, Greece, Italy, Poland, and the United Kingdom told the pollster Ipsos their purchasing power had fallen over the past 3 years, mostly because of higher food prices, higher fuel prices, heating and rent bills. The hardest hit country was Greece, where 68% of respondents said their spending power had fallen a lot or somewhat since 2019. This was followed by France in second position with 63%, Italy in third position with 57%, Germany in fourth position with 54%, and Britain in fifth position with 48%. Poland was in sixth position with 38%. About 80% of respondents said they had already been forced to make significant compromises, including cutting down on travel, 62%, cutting down on heating, 47%, borrowing from friends and family, 42%, finding a second job, 40%, and skipping their meals, 29%. Across the six countries, 64% said they were now often or sometimes unable to decide what to cut next, as they had already cut what they could have cut. 28% said they were overdrawn by mid-month, and 27% often or sometimes feared losing their home. On average, about 27% of respondents across the six countries said their financial and material situation was precarious, defined as one unexpected expenditure could change everything.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions, and issues parents have regarding Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified family. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Sister Rehana Kazemi. She has done Bachelor's of Science in Applied Psychology. She's a researcher in the Hafsa Ilmi of Qom, and her research right now is on best trainers and coaches for students in non-Islamic countries with Islamic perspective. A very warm welcome, Sister, and Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thank you very much.
You told us a lot of important things that parents need to take care of in the age, especially from 14 to 21. Here in our previous session, we ended our program with the negligence towards girl child. The girls are neglected, especially in Asian countries, wherein they are said that you got nothing to do with this. We don't need your decisions. Nobody asked you, or things like that, the statements like that a girl hears. How would this child develop into a society?
First of all, this is the duty of the parents to treat equally and to treat with the same affection and love to the girls like boys.
All right.
Do not make difference between girls and
because
boys.
Because of their gender.
Yes, because of their gender. And because the girls are more sensitive than boys.
Yeah.
They feel everything like a little things. They can pick up a very small thing.
You're trying to say that they get irritated over very small things.
Very small. And they are more like sensitive than boys. And especially in love and affection, the girls are more sensitive. They want more love from their parents. They want more love from their brothers. So parents always need to show their love to the girls equally to boys. And do not treat them like they are inferior from boys, because this is a type of complex which develops in the girls, and they always feel the inferiority complex.
Mm-hmm.
In this complex, they lose their self-confidence. And when they grow up, this inferiority complex always travel in their personalities, and they will try to seek this love from outside, out of the house, like when they go in university or they go in the college.
So there you go. So we do have this problem today in the society, wherein the relationships between girls and boys, unfortunately Muslims as well, is getting more and more, the ratio is going up. And that's because you're saying they're ignored in the family. Yeah.
Ignorance or negligence of the parents always create the problems, especially in girls, because they are sensitive. And if a child could not receive a love or affection from the house, from the family, definitely he will try to seek this love from outside. And maybe in the form of friends. And if a girl
has no knowledge about mahram and non-mahram,
definitely,
then she can develop
she
into much
someone
more
will cheer
complex
up,
relationships.
Will give her importance. She will definitely feel that I am more important in sight of him rather than my parents.
Why? And even if the guy is, lying, still the girls get into the trap.
Yes, because the parents did not work on the ground. They need to figure out this thing from the day one, and they need to treat equally. That's why I'm saying the religious women and the religious parents, they play a major role in a child personality. And Islamic education is very important for a mother and for a father.
All right, sister, we'll discuss more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is IRIB English Radio. I am with Sister Rehana Kazemi, and we're discussing about a girl child who's being neglected and now seeks love outside in the society. Even if a boy is lying, sister, you said the girl will still accept. Because don't you think the parents always love, but the problem goes in the expression of that love?
Maybe. But, I realize, especially in Asian families, the main problem is negligence.
Right.
And the main thing, the parents need to figure out where they are going. They need to keep an eye on the girls as well. What are their children doing? Some parents do not care about who are their friends, because nowadays, friend and media have a main influence.
All right, so you're trying to say in upbringing,
yes,
it's not just parents today.
Yes.
It's also the media.
Media and friends. nowadays we can see every child has a mobile.
Yeah.
In quite young age, if a child has a mobile and parents do not care,
what not a big issue
talking
now,
about that. And maybe she or he pretend that they are sleeping, they are in their bedrooms, and parents like think, oh, they are sleeping. But maybe she's chatting with his friend or with her friend. So this is very important for the parents to keep an eye on their children. They have to fix their screen time. And they do not give the mobile, especially in nights. And they need to check the bedrooms when their children are sleeping. Do not neglect their children. Do not give them so much freedom that they will do whatever they want to do.
They misuse that freedom.
Yeah. And they will try to misuse everything.
All right. So even that misusing, we came to a conclusion, comes from that neglecting part.
Yes.
All right. Well, sister, we have another audience question over here. That child is developing into a backbiting child. How do parents fix this problem? It's a girl who is in her early teens.
If the parent said he's backbiting, this is not a problem. This is the cause of something which develops in his personality and parents did not realize.
Because it's a sign of something?
Sign of something, and it is from the early childhood. The main part of every problem is the negligency.
Right.
Because when in the sensitive age, when you neglect the child, little or small things, because some children want extra attention.
Yes, and we see attention-seeking behavior.
Attention-seeking behavior. And the backbiting comes in the same behavior. Because in the early age, when I was working with the children, some children want extra attention and they are attention-seeker. They will ask the things which have no base.
Or no, like, relation.
No relation. For example, I was in the class and one child came to me and he was saying, this boy is saying to me this one. This boy is doing to this thing. He is just touching me. He was sitting on the bench. He was not doing anything. When I called him, he said, no, I was doing my work. And I was watching as well. So this is reason. When we neglect the reason.
All right, so the child is coming up and telling
yes,
look
he
at
wants
me.
The attention. Because
look
he wants
at me,
the attention.
Give me attention.
Because child, I was doing my thing so and he
problem,
wants the attention.
Problem seems to be very deep down.
Yes.
I'll talk to you more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back. You're listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is IRIB English Radio. I'm with Sister Rehana Kazemi, and we reached a very interesting point. We were talking about backbiting. The children who develop this behavior, sister, you say this is a kind of attention-seeking behavior,
yes.
And this is developed into a child who is neglected.
Yeah, especially in these families who have three or four children. One child should be like that because the mother could not treat everyone same and she's busy doing this and that. Your child will start screaming. This is one thing as well. He will do backbiting.
Children who scream a lot today.
Yeah. Nowadays, children are so sensitive and so attention-seeking.
I think they're stressed as well.
Yes, too much stressed. And, you know, in nowadays, maybe, I don't know, how was our childhood? Because in these days, every child is so attention-seeker. If you have three or four children, that's very difficult for a mother, if she has four children, that she will give the same attention to everyone. In this case, definitely one of them will scream. After his screaming, the other will start, no, I did not done anything. He was just touching me, the second point of attention, that he wants to attain your attention.
Screaming.
Yeah.
Screaming,
backbiting, hitting, these all kinds of attention seeking. They want to seek your attention. So for a mother, this is an alarming time. When a child is saying something about his brother or sister, mother needs to know about the reason. Why is he saying that? My brother is hitting me. What is the reason? These piles up, when they will grow up, these all things piles up and they will become like a backbiting. They becomes like a screaming in a negative behavior and stress and depression. These are the reasons which start from early childhood.
Right.
And we neglect these reasons. We do not care about these reasons. So for a mother, it's very important to learn about the children's behavior. How
so do like
these big things come up?
Yeah.
Not all of a sudden. These all big things come up from the early age.
All right. So we basically have been discussing about the teens, the problems that are in the teens. But you are saying these problems also root back in the early childhood?
Every problem has the root cause.
All right. So the problems that a child develops in the, for example, in his teens, has somewhere roots in his early childhood
while
he was neglected by the parents, and that's why now he develops into a screaming child, a bossy behavior child, or other attention-seeking behaviors, or even backbiting, you said.
Yeah, I will say, because in the psychology, we will say some children in teenage, they behave like wild animals. Why? Wild behavior. What is the wild behavior? So why he's behaving like this? These kind of children, they are neglected children. Parents, for example, mom is doing work, father is doing job, the child all day, he's with the babysitter, mother when she comes from the...
Or nowadays with a mobile phone.
Yes, and playing on the PlayStations and these horror games, overage games. When these all things piles up, that child behave like this.
Develops into a child of wild behavior. Thank you so much, sister, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. If you have any questions, dear audiences, comments or suggestions, please contact us on englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on the social media websites just by searching Call of Islam Radio. You can also listen to our programs on our official website, that's www.parstoday.com. Until another program, fi amanillah and God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.